Since we started reading the Vajra Chedika Sutra, that is most accurately translated as the Diamond Cutting Sutra, and that actually became a core element of this retreat, I thought it would be useful to keep the momentum and continue reading from this sutra, because it is indeed a very special, crucial, powerful, clarifying document that reveals many subtle aspects of the Buddha nature and of the realization of the Buddha nature. So, without further ado, the first, I think they call them chapters, they're very short, so sections. The first is simply setting the scene, Buddha preparing to give a satsang, and then second section, basically it begins and he's asked questions, and then in the third section, which we read at the retreat, he is teaching. I'll give a few lines from that just to jog your memory. The Buddha said to Subhuti, those who would now set forth on the bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. However many beings there are, in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they have form or no form, perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? No one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self or of a being or of a life or of a soul. In the other translation that I read last time, it was slightly differently stated very clearly several times. There is no sentient being. There are no sentient beings for a bodhisattva to save. And thus the vow to save sentient beings is really a vow to recognize that there are no sentient beings. I was reading a Chinese John Master's translation. The one I decided to continue with, however, is the one by Red Pine, which I don't always think is the best, but the good news is he gives a huge amount of commentary from other sages, and I think overall presents the best presentation of the text, although I think it must be updated. So I'm going to read now section 4. Moreover, Subhuti, when bodhisattvas give a gift, they should not be attached to a thing. When they give a gift, they should not be attached to anything at all. Not to a sight. When they give a gift, they shouldn't be attached to a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or a dharma when they give a gift. Thus, fearless bodhisattvas should give a gift without being attached to the perception of an object. And why, Subhuti, the body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. What do you think? Is space easy to measure? No, it is not, Bhagavan. So he goes on into recognizing space is measureless, the merit is measureless of giving a gift in the proper way. And the Buddha said, so it is, Subhuti, the body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give without being attached is not easy to measure. Thus, those who set forth on the bodhisattva path should give without being attached to the perception of an object. So let's update this a little bit, because I think today, and given the fact that most people will be thinking about this not from the level of bodhisattva mind, but of ego mind, that most gifts or even just interchanges are always with a very subtle quid pro quo. In other words, I'll give you something. Maybe it's not an object. Maybe it's a compliment. Maybe it's a certain kind of look. Maybe it's answering an email. Maybe it's trying to give you a teaching by not answering an email. But whatever it might be, it is done without actually a quid pro quo. It is done as an act of a bodhisattva giving the only gift that really a bodhisattva should think about giving, which is a transmission of liberated consciousness, not something to satisfy an ego who has a certain expectation of what they will get. And an ego, because an ego is a paired set of collapsed quantum and qualium wave functions, cannot learn, it cannot grow. It is stuck with its particular set of projections, its particular set of attitudes, its particular forms of a negative feeling about certain others. And those attitudes are reflexive, they're automatic, they can't be changed until the quantum waves decollapse. And so that is the gift that a bodhisattva would give. But that gift can only be given when the bodhisattva's wave functions are decollapsed and they recognize the decollapsed potentiality of the one to whom they are speaking and offer the energy that will enable the initiation of a certain kind of growth through a certain kind of questioning, of an uncanny response to what the ego expected, that will suddenly cause it to be momentarily awakened from the trance of that collapsed wave function. And that presents the opportunity to learn something new from a situation that would otherwise simply have been another business as usual and justification of more of whatever it is that the ego is based upon, which is often finding fault, staying separate and rebellious, and in a state where it is not needing to actually relate to the reality of the other. Because if the ego relates to the reality of a bodhisattva, then their wave functions will in fact be decollapsed. And so rather than relate, the ego projects. And when the projection is not met, then it'll be replaced by a more negative projection. But no actual intersubjective relationality happens that is based upon the real, but always based upon a collapsed form that had been grown into or matured or stuck and fixated in the past and has not been able to grow beyond whatever level they reached before that collapse of the function, which often happens during trauma in childhood, when the ego defenses must keep certain information that's unbearable out of consciousness, and the conscious mind reduces itself to a very defensive posture and closes the walls of perception. So tunnel vision engages, and it is compensated for by fantasy and often a manic kind of a feeling of superiority, but based upon fear and paranoia and the ego's lack of being. So without being able to break through that, and the ego cannot do that on its own, it must surrender in some way to a bodhisattva, which could be in a formal context of a guru, but one would have to be humble enough to be willing to be corrected and to grow, and not to assume that one's projections on the other are accurate. Because in the ego level, you can never know if your thoughts and feelings are accurate, because you don't know anything other than those. You cannot measure the infinite space of potentiality from that small closed position. And so you cannot know who the other is or what are their real intentions until you have opened up to possibilities that do not exist within the frame of reference of the ego mind. This is the technical difficulty in dealing with any kind of therapeutic enterprise, that the wave functions will not decollapse out of fear that the ego will then not know who it is. It will lose its bearings, and it will have to trust the other. And the one thing the ego totally refuses to do is trust, to have faith, either in its own real self, its real nature that would allow it to decollapse the waves without danger, or the other and the other's compassionate support that actually wants the person to grow, but that they must face their own hardened attitude before they're even able to take a step toward wanting to repair a rupture that will always otherwise occur in every relationship when the projections are threatened and the expectations and the quid pro quos are not met. So this is the difficulty that appears in all relationships, really, even with two egos or with two beings in the soul level, being that the soul level also is still within the illusion. And the limited repertoire of capacity for complementarity within those smaller frames of identity than that of the Buddha nature will always reach a point of failure to communicate, failure to remain in unity and oneness, a place in which difference becomes antagonism because of the threatening nature of taking in some difference that will totally make your own being different from what it was and drop one into an unknown relation and paradigm of reality in which no familiar context can be drawn together to be able to enable one to speak and to relate with an open heart. And so it is this fear of being completely lost and unraveled and depersonalized that's responsible for those rigid wave function collapses to be so strongly defended against becoming different from who you were the year before, the even 10 years before, the fixated, obsessive and neurotic states of the ego can last a lifetime and never change. Even though on the surface someone gets a PhD and learns all kinds of sophisticated thought patterns and reads all kinds of books, but the infantile ego nature with its collapsed function based on hatred of parents that were not unconditionally loving or providing guidance or providing support for growth and differentiation and individuation, that same attitude of reactivity and hatred and fury remain just below the surface of the ego, and therefore it must remain superficial not to trigger a charge that it could not prevent from erupting and leaking out and creating more problems. And so the ego in its fragility must withdraw into a false self in order to sustain an ability to function at a minimal level. But this will always be a hell realm for the ego that yearns to know a vastness of being and of creative intelligence and of a feeling of empowerment, but can only have that with a false master's discourse that will not bear actual profound conversation, let alone Dharma combat. And so this is the sad situation of egos at the end of Kali Yuga. And it's only by the practice of being able to give the gift of sight with the eye of Shiva, or the eye of Buddha, if you prefer, that understands all this, has a compassionate relationship to it, and provides a space in which humility can at least reach a point of being able to express a question. Remember that question that Parsifal didn't ask to the Grail King who was wounded, what ails you? He couldn't ask because it would break through the conventional rules of knighthood and he would be on unsolid ground and not know how to deal with whatever the king might say back to him. And so that sense of inadequacy that haunts the ego and that causes it to then collude with those who will support its sense of superiority will preclude connecting to someone who is more advanced, like a bodhisattva, and to learn from them how to be free of those defensive states that have caused life to be short-circuited from the capacity to connect to the power of God consciousness that remains only glimpsed when one is in occasional altered states due to substances or from some other kind of a positive desirous projections that cause one to be able to momentarily leave the fearful state and satisfy a drive for stimulation and release. But the ego cannot sustain love, cannot sustain an active deepening of a relation through continuing to go beyond the frontier that had been reached and to break free of all that is known, to discover who one really is, that cannot be known until one has gone beyond and let die all that one thought one was. And if one doesn't have the courage to go on that quest of self-discovery, which requires the ego death of the old structure, meaning the decollapse of the wave function, then life can never begin. And there will always be a sense of needing to run away. So I hope that everyone becomes the bodhisattva through connecting to that bodhisattva energy and recognizing that there are no objects to want or to be afraid of, and that all there is to really connect to is the emptiness of the realization that there is no ego, no sentient being. There is no life for an ego. There is no soul. There is no truth. There is no love. And life can only be worth living when all of that pattern and fixated structure has been shattered and the infinite space has been entered and one becomes the measureless Buddha mind in all of the fullness of the Absolute Self. May you be filled with the peace that comes of decollapsing, dissolving, eliminating all egoic identity structures, conscious and unconscious, through the surrender of the heart to the presence of infinite unconditional love. And having the courage to express it and to see it in all. And may one have the grace of the deeper peace that comes of the realization of bodhisattvahood, that one has never been a sentient being in a world, nor is there any such creature or entity, and the freedom of consciousness within the one infinite intelligence is all that is real. And one accepts that freedom, that power, that love, that beauty, that joy, that eternal nature that is unborn and deathless, and transmits that throughout the infinite unified field. And may one know the supreme peace of the Supra Buddha, Paramashiva, the absolute source of all that appears, and to whom all must return as the world itself dissolves in light, and only the infinite mind of the Absolute Beloved Self abides forevermore. Namaste. Namaste.